Imagine yourself immersed in a beautiful landscape and being moved by the view before your eyes. To remember the experience, perhaps you might take a photograph. But while that photograph can snap a single moment, a still image doesn't really reflect the way your original experience unfolded through time. Can writing achieve something different? Both William Wordsworth and James Joyce were interested in the problem of representing our stream of conscious experience. Adam James Cuthbert of the University of Dundee trains his eye on the poetry and fiction that they produced and suggests that their literary efforts can be best understood through an analogy with the camera. This podcast is brought to you by the Department of English Studies at Durham University. It was recorded during our series of late summer lectures in 2018.
This paper today is going to explore the topic of the stream of consciousness in William Wordsworth's Prelude, 1798 to 1839, and James Joyce's A Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, 1916, and Ulysses, 1922. It's going to argue that Wordsworth prefigures and anticipates Joyce's cinematic representations of the stream of consciousness. Now, this paper is actually using the Four Texts, 1995 edition of the Prelude, edited by Jonathan Wordsworth. And it's going to focus on the two-part prelude of 1799, referring to the earlier Was It For This fragment of 1798 were relevant. This paper begins by defining the stream of consciousness as a psychophenomenal concept in the work of the Victorian philosopher Shadworth Holloway Hodgson, 1832 to 1912, before considering Wordsworth's early account of the stream of consciousness in the two-part prelude that predates its formal definition by Hodgson. The paper then examines Wordsworth's development of the stream of consciousness as an intermedial narrative technique within the spots of time, which are defined as a highly visual kind of autobiographical memory that underlies the cognitive capacity for mental time travel, which Wordsworth employs as literary practice in the spots of time. The spots of time emphasize memory as spectacle. They mediate sense perceptions along the temporal flow of the stream of consciousness as moving visual images that are infused by techniques derived from the panorama. However, they also demonstrate an affinity with photography and cinema. Specifically, the spots of time prefigure the camera eye as an intermedial focalization technique that is also employed by Joyce. Thus, Wordsworth can be said to anticipate Joyce's intermedial techniques for representing the stream of consciousness, particularly of the autobiographical focaliser Stephen Dedalus in Portrait and Ulysses. Joyce also demonstrates literary practice and mental time travel in his treatment of the stream of consciousness. As a psychophenomenal concept, the stream of consciousness was originally defined by Hodgson in Time and Space, a Metaphysical Essay, published in 1865, where he sought to, quote, trace, as it were, the stream of consciousness and of existence to its source or sources, and to deduce the relation of these sources to each other. He later developed and refined his account of the stream of consciousness in The Metaphysic of Experience, which was published in 1898. Now, I mean, you would normally associate the stream of consciousness with the psychologist William James, and he obviously published his account of the stream of consciousness in The Principles of Psychology, which was published in 1891. But he actually got the term stream of consciousness from Hodgson, and he even cites his debt to Hodgson in The Principles of Psychology. Now, according to Holly Anderson, who's one of the few scholars actually working on Hodgson in the present day, Hodgson's methodology in The Metaphysic was, quote, an early version of phenomenology of consciousness, and, in particular, of the present moment in experience is all that is generally available for analysis. What is actually real must be actually in experience, and everything that has ever been real has been so because it was a present moment in experience. In The Metaphysic, Hodgson explains that, quote, whatever we experience is always the content of a present moment of experience, which we may call the empirical present. The empirical present is the time in which the contents of consciousness actually transpire. We have no actual experience, Hodgson writes, which is not included in the content of the empirical present moment, though we may infer from this content that we had such and such experiences actually in the past, or shall have such and such experiences in the future. memories, anticipations, and imaginings all exist only as part of an empirical present moment, though what we call their contents have had, will have, or may have actual existence in past or future time. The empirical present is, Hodgson writes, as it were, a transverse section or segment taken out of a stream of consciousness consisting of many various currents. Herbert Wilden Carr, who was a contemporary of Hodgson, he observed that for Hodgson, consciousness is, quote, a reflection. It is a looking back on a receding stream. This stream is moving away from the empirical present into the past and is yet retained in the present as it moves away. The stream of consciousness flows in two directions, possessing both a forward moving or prospective direction and a backward moving or retrospective direction at once. As we imagine past experiences within as we imagine experiences that may or may not happen in the future and look back upon past experiences within the empirical present. Barry Dayton, who published an account of the stream of consciousness in 2000, which is just called The Stream of Consciousness, he explains that the stream metaphor is appropriate because, quote, just as a stream consists of an uninterrupted flow of water from start to finish, the stretches of our conscious lives consist of an uninterrupted flow of experience. Hodgson clarifies that, although consciousness or experience, wherever we come upon it, in any empirical present moment, has the form of a stream of varied content, this must not be confused with the psychological idea that consciousness as a whole is a continuous stream flowing on from the beginning to the end of an individual's conscious life, without gaps or breaks in its continuity. The idea that an individual's consciousness, taken as a whole, is something which exists without breaks in its continuity, it's not an idea which has the support of experience in its favour. For the consciousness of which we speak is an object of imagination and thought, and so taken is interrupted by frequent intervals of unconsciousness, as in dreamless sleep. Nevertheless, the stream of consciousness is an experiential phenomenon that is known to consciousness. Now, by consciousness, Hodgson means consciousness as existing in an individual human being, which is limited by the sensitive and active powers of the being to which it belongs. Consciousness is related to awareness and perception. We are conscious because we are aware as we perceive things, and we are aware because we are conscious when we perceive things. Consciousness is also concerned with personal knowledge, belief, understanding, and experience. It is, William J. Mander explains, quote, both our only point of contact with reality and our only tool for its investigation. Moreover, consciousness is composed of various feelings, Hodgson writes, the durations of which overlap each other. In experiences it actually incurs an empirical present. And I quote Hodgson, time duration filled with feeling is perceived as filled with simultaneously existing and overlapping feelings. It's the perception of the overlapping of feelings within the empirical present that constitutes the empirical continuity of the stream of consciousness, which, Hodgson says, is never broken, because at whatever point we select in it, we always find that some feeling has begun before some other feeling ends. For Hodgson, feeling is the material element of consciousness, which, in some modification or another, constitutes all consciousness. In time and space, he divides feelings into three categories. Those derived from the five special senses, sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell. Those derived from bodily sensations, and those derived from emotions, which are the combination of feelings from the first two categories. Different feelings are always at work together and are connected by belonging to one organized body. The portion of space, Hodgson explains, that we call the body gives unity in point of space to all of its feelings and to all of its world of phenomena. consciousness is connected to phenomena, so objects, by the feelings of the body. Moreover, every feeling, whenever sensation or emotion, must occupy some duration of time, however short. It could not be a feeling if it did not. In A Metaphysic, Hodgson elaborates that every feeling occupies some portion of time. It is part of the continuous time stream of consciousness. The empirical continuity of the stream of consciousness also depends upon the perception of a single continuous stream of time in all perceptions, which form part of a single consciousness. The stream of consciousness, both when first known to us and always, exists as a nexus of perceptions. It can be defined as an ensemble of perceptions that's unified both at and over time by consciousness. By perception here, Hodgson means a category of feeling that subsumes all our kinds of feelings. It refers to experiences we have when we look at things, hear things, touch things, taste things, and smell things. Perceptions, like other feelings, consist of some sense quality and some time duration, which are inseparable, though distinguishable from each other. Nothing can enter into experience, Hodgson emphasizes, unless it has first been perceived. All perception is retrospective. An experience is always the content of a perception as it passes away into memory. The duration of every content of consciousness passes away into memory along with its content. Anderson has elaborated that Hodgson was the first philosopher, quote, to develop an account of the temporal structure of experience and to explicitly relate the temporal characteristics of consciousness to the body and brain. So he was the first neurophenomenologist, essentially, even before it was really a notion. In A Metaphysic, Anderson explains, Hodgson moves away from a phenomenological bracketing of the external world and what causes our experience to connect our experience directly to neuronal processes, so the neurons of the brain. Hodgson explains that consciousness is dependent upon neurocerebral processes which go on simultaneously with it and pursue the same direction in time. When we ask, he writes, why it is that such and such a sense perception occurs in consciousness at such and such a time, it is because such and such a neurocerebral process is just taking place, or is taking place, at the same time. Moreover, the whole time stream of consciousness is located in the body, which is the centre of our whole external world, as well as the centre of our feelings. The first perception of the location of consciousness in the body, he writes, is the decisive and frontal moment that leads to the perception of ourselves as a real conscious being that has feelings and experiences. Mander explains that the body provides not just the location, but the real condition of our mental life. A real condition is something that depends on the existence or continuance of something else for its own existence. Consciousness depends for its existence on the neurocerebral workings of our body. In identifying the body as the real condition of our consciousness, Mander writes, we are then able to arrive at the idea of ourselves as a distinct and permanent psychological subject of consciousness. Now, this idea is also explored by Wordsworth in the two-part prelude. A philosophical poem, the two-part prelude is arguably concerned with the phenomenology of consciousness. Within the poem, Stephen Jill writes, Wordsworth, quote, drives backwards in time to ground his speculation about how one apprehends the physical world and becomes conscious of an independent self. Wordsworth draws upon his own experiences, hoping that I, by such inquiry, am taught to understand myself, while also reflecting on the real conditions of how we become conscious beings, whose consciousness is limited by its cognitive faculties. and also depends on the continuing existence of the body and brain. An autobiographical fragment that nevertheless suggests completedness. The two-part prelude is mainly concerned with the theme, and I quote Wordsworth, of the growth of mental power and love of nature's works that he traces back to the very beginnings of his childhood. In the opening passage of the poem, Wordsworth contemplates the influences from the natural world, already, quote, composed my thoughts to more than infant softness, giving me, amongst the fretful dwellings of mankind, a knowledge, a dim earnest of the calm which nature breathes among the fields and groves. Now, his use of the word softness is interesting because he's using it to describe the physical condition of the early human mind, and this suggests that Wordsworth precedently recognises the phenomenal existence of what's called neuroplasticity, which Daniel Glazer explains allows for a wide range of developmental opportunities to influence how the brain develops in early childhood. Now, neuroplasticity is linked to sensitive or critical periods that are typical for the species and are required by the developing organism. During these periods, particular experiences that are usually developmentally expected produce stronger effects on the brain. The brain development of individual children, and I quote Glazer again, is designed to be adaptive to the particular environment prevailing during the sensitive period. In Wordsworth's case, he connects particular developmental experiences to his experiences of the natural world. He recalls how, from a young age, quote, the earth and common face of nature spoke to me rememberable things, sometimes, 'tis true, by quaint associations, yet not vain nor profitless, albeit lifeless then and doomed to sleep, until maturer seasons called them forth to impregnate and elevate the mind. Like Hodgson, Wordsworth recognises feeling as the material element of consciousness. How shall I trace the history, he asks, where seek the origin of what I then have felt? Jonathan Wordsworth and Stephen Gill note that Wordsworth in the two-part prelude examined, quote, his childhood of natural influence, which he felt to be the source and guarantee of his poetic power, in the hope, and I quote Wordsworth, that he might fetch reproaches from my former years, whose power may spur me on in manhood now mature to honourable toil. So, and that's towards the poem he entitled The Recluse, which he never actually wrote during his lifetime, because he was a bloody lazy writer, though early plans for The Recluse were made in 1798. I mean, the truth is he was never actually satisfied with the prelude, and the prelude was just a constituent part of The Recluse. So in the two-part prelude, Wordsworth draws upon his childhood memories for poetic inspiration, whose content, filled with feeling, unfolds in the process of remembering the past. As he does so, he intertwines the empirical present with the past along the retrospective flow of the stream of consciousness, which he also recognises as an experiential phenomenon known to all human beings. In the second part of the two-part prelude, he postulates, but who shall parcel out his intellect by geometric rules, split like a province into round and square? Who knows the individual hour in which his habits were first sown, even as a seed? Who that shall point as with a wand and say, this portion of the river of my mind came from yon fountain? So in this passage, Wordsworth draws upon nature imagery, the planted seed, to describe the organic material growth and development of consciousness after its formation in early childhood. He emphasises that the physical growth of the human being follows the genetic principles of the species, while our mental development also builds on early ingrained habits that influence our future perceptions. He employs an analogous metaphor, river of my mind, that aptly captures and characterises the stream-like movement and temporal flow of consciousness. He observes the empirical continuity of the stream of consciousness, which is composed of a continuous succession of overlapping feelings, that is, sense perceptions, within portions of time constituting the empirical present. In the two-part prelude, Wordsworth inquires after the origin of particular experiences, which he phenomenologically brackets off from the rest of his lived experience, in the form of visual representations of these experiences within his memory. In the poem, he employs the literary practice of ekphrasis, which Murray Krieger has defined as any sought-for equivalent in words of any visual image. In order to realise visualisations of his past, he examines specific memories that he calls the spots of time. In the first part of the two-part prelude, Wordsworth explains that there are in our existence spots of time which with distinct preeminence retain a fructifying virtue, whence our minds, especially the imaginative power, are nourished and invisibly repaired. Such moments chiefly seem to have their date in our first childhood. The spots of time perform a dual function in the two-part prelude. At its simplest level, the spot of time is a kind of autobiographical or episodic memory that retrieves memorable or formative experiences from early childhood in the form of visual representations that in their substantial lineaments are depicted on the brain. And that's quoting Wordsworth. As memories, the spots of time constitute portions of the stream of consciousness, filled with feeling, sense perception, that can be recalled at any time. Rachel Daniel has discussed the etymological definition of spot in Wordsworth's time, which could mean an interval of time or locality. The spots of time can be defined as portions of time that involve a phenomenological overlap between psychological and geographical spots. They are the memories of specific places at specific times. Phenomenologically speaking then, the spot of time is a highly visual kind of episodic memory that mediates the remembering of personally experienced events along the retrospective flow of the stream of consciousness, with a special reference to experiences that happened in particular places at particular times. As a kind of episodic memory, the spots of time underlie the cognitive capacity for mental time travel into the past. That is, the ability to mentally project ourselves backwards in time when we remember our past in order to relive past experiences. However, we're also capable of forward time travel into the future when we imagine future experiences so as to pre-live these future experiences. Michael Corballis explains that mental time travel not only involves the sensation, the feeling of virtually travelling in time, but the sensation of virtually travelling in space as well, since, he notes, movement in time necessarily involves trajectories in space. In the spots of time, Wordsworth visually represents journeys through familiar landscapes from his childhood. The spots of time also confer phenomenal awareness of the subjective time in which events happened. They refer to the private order of time, the time of personal experience, that is the temporal domain of the stream of consciousness. In both explicitly identified spots of time that are presented in the first part of the two-part prelude, Wordsworth chronologically dates each spot, thereby demonstrating his awareness of the subjective time when specific experiences happened. The first spot is from an early season, during the twilight of a memorable life, which is a wonderful phrase, at the onset of autobiographical memory recall, while he was yet an urchin, one who scarce could hold a burrow. Well, the second is dated long after, though his childhood had not ceased, to the day before the Christmas holidays began. As a rhetorical form, on the other hand, the spots of time reproduce the phenomenal experience of blended past and present associated with the act of remembering. Herbert Lindenberger explains that within the spots, Wordsworth engages in a dynamic two-way movement back and forth between present and past. Wordsworth observes the process of remembering the past, quote, "Those days have such self-presence in my heart that when I think of them, I seem two consciousnesses, conscious of myself and of some other being." that he identifies with the perspective of his childhood self, which he relives within the spots of time. In doing so, he intertwines the empirical present with the past. Sybil Eakin notes that with the spots of time of the two-part prelude, Wordsworth sets out to demonstrate faithfulness to the point of view inhabited by his childhood self, which he relives in the act of remembering the past. The spots of time also connect phenomenal processes of memory to the cognitive faculty of imagination. As a rhetorical form, they emphasise that the act of remembering the past is actually one of imaginative reconstruction that stimulates and enriches the actively recollecting adult mind in the empirical present. This is especially the case when it comes to what Wordsworth calls the time of unrememberable being, as he puts it in Was It For This, of very earliest childhood, the form's opening passage of the two-part prelude, of which there is no possible autobiographical recall. In Was It For This, Wordsworth observes that it is necessary in this case to speak of things that are fashioned fondly to compensate for the dearth of autobiographical memory from this time. And this is reflected in the rhetorical and speculative language that comprises the opening of the two-part prelude. And I quote it, "Was it for this that one, the fairest of all rivers, loved to blend his murmurs with my nurse's song, and from his fords and shallows sent a voice that flowed among my dreams?" Now his language here suggests that the sense perceptions he dates to this time are entirely imaginative constructs of what most likely happened during this time. But obviously he has no distinct recollection of that period. James P. Davis notes that while Wordsworth didn't originate the semiotic structures by which the mind processes experience, he nevertheless designed the rhetorical forms commonly used to simulate such processes in the spots of time, which Davis notes have become a standard way to represent consciousness and stream of consciousness works. The spots of time emphasize the stream of consciousness as the narrative structure and central technique of the two-part prelude, which enables Wordsworth to recall formative and memorable experiences from his childhood through literary practice of mental time travel. He innovates practice of ekphrasis in the spots of time to realise visual representations of personally experienced events. The spots of time mediate episodes of past sense perceptions as discrete temporal sequences of moving visual images along the retrospective flow of the stream of consciousness. Now, the spots of time also demonstrate intermedial properties, and I realise I'm going on quite a bit about the spots of time, but bear with me. As Wordsworth further develops practice of ekphrasis, Kate Newell has identified ekphrasis as a form of intermedial reference. It represents a moment, quote, in which one medium invokes the attributes of another, and in so doing, creates the illusion of the presence of that medium. This definition of ekphrasis can be applied to the spots of time. The intermedial properties of the spots can be said to lie in their panoramic qualities. And on your right is an example of, you know, the panorama. So Wordsworth borrows techniques from the panorama as he emphasizes memory as a kind of phenomenal spectacle that enables him to become immersed in the virtual world of the past that is reconstructed through the imagination via mental time travel. Gayu explains that the panorama presented the spectator with an enclosed illusionary visual space that completely surrounded him. In the panorama, he writes, the spectator is immediately surrounded on all sides by a three-dimensional interior that's imperceptibly connected to the two-dimensional action depicted on the canvas. The visual space of the panorama appears to be the immediate source of reality, creating a sense of journeying through space and time. In the spots of time, Wordsworth adapts the sensation of virtual time and space travel achieved by technical illusions of the panorama into a phenomena realized by mental time travel. The spots of time, hence, also mediate past sense perceptions is moving visual images enthused by techniques derived from the panorama. Moreover, the spots of time attest to quasi-filmic, which is to say, quasi-cinematic graphic qualities in Wordsworth's poetry. Wordsworth further develops ekphrasis into the semiotic inscription of movement in time, as he prefigures cinematic techniques for representing the stream of consciousness in the spots of time. Specifically, he prefigures the development of the camera eye as an intermedial focalization technique that mediates the stream of consciousness as moving visual images in the spots of time. It also registers an infinity with photography. The spots of time can be described, and I quote Scott Hess, as discrete snapshots of experience that are animated by the temporal flow of consciousness. The spots of time present a camera eye perspective on scenes in the past. In the spots, Wordsworth conveys, and I quote Alberto Gabrielli, the photographic recording of a specific point of view, the individualized point of view that's captured by a moving observer, which he specifically identifies with the perspective of his childhood self. In this sense, he can be said to anticipate Joyce's intermedial techniques for representing the stream of consciousness in both A Portrait of an Artist and Ulysses. In both works, Joyce also employs the camera eye, as well as demonstrating literary practice and mental time travel in his treatment of the stream of consciousness, following the spots of time as a model or example. Joyce focuses on representations of visual perception as a distinct part of the stream of consciousness through the camera eye technique. Now, Christian Quellner has explored the camera eye as a conceptual metaphor that emphasizes phenomenological connections between the subjectivity and perception of the viewer-spectator and the mechanical apparatus of the filmic camera, which inscribes a mediated point of view that is vicariously inhabited by the spectator. He states that a camera eye metaphor draws on the body or the mechanism of the camera as an explicitory frame in terms of the way human or camera vision is understood. Notions of the camera eye help to identify, demarcate, and illustrate basic elements of cinema. However, the camera eye also corroborates an embodied and embedded view of the mind that's based on a functional continuity between brain, mind, and technology. The camera eye, he elaborates, reconstructs the human body by mapping across and projecting from bodily and technological domains, that is, human visual perception on the one hand, and the visual apparatus of the camera on the other. The camera eye not only tells us something about human vision in terms of the optical apparatus of a camera, but also draws on principles of visual perception in order to illustrate how cinema works. It phenomenologically combines the mechanisms of the camera with optical principles underlying visual perception that also form the basis of cinematography. Moreover, the camera eye exemplifies what Anne Freiberg has called the mobilized virtual gaze. The virtual gaze, she explains, is not a direct perception, but a received perception mediated through visual representation. It describes a gaze that travels an imaginary flannery through imaginary elsewhere and imaginary elsewhen. Although the virtual gaze was historically present in pre-filmic media, such as the panorama, photography, the magic lantern, and the stereoscope, the cinematograph significantly combined the mobile with the virtual. The movement of the camera offered spectators not only a spatially mobilized visuality that was present in earlier medial forms, but also a temporal mobility that was lacking in these technologies, which nevertheless emerged out of their capacity to virtually transport the spectator in time. Quellner notes that a camera eye is not limited to cinema. It rather predates film history. The virtual gaze of the cinematograph merely expressed and intensified a pre-existing impulse to produce a perceptual illusion of what Freiberg calls unmediated referentiality, one that, that extended in space and persisted across time. Now, this perceptual illusion is arguably most effectively realized through the subjective camera, which is a focalization technique that can be traced back to the early years of cinema, which attempts, Julian Moreno explains, to recreate the only reality which is truly real, the living reality of perception. The subjective camera posits a phenomenological model of the camera eye that simultaneously treats the camera as an eye and the eye as a camera. We see through the mediated point of view of a focalizer in a techno-optical attempt to reproduce the subjective experience of visual perception. The camera eye attempts, Julian Hannish explains, to express in an extended way the ongoing sensory perception of a diegetic flesh and blood human character. The mobilized virtual gaze of the camera situates the spectator, as it were, inside the character's head, perceiving moving images that are supposed to signify the character's sensory experience of the diegetic world. In Portrait and Ulysses, Joyce employs the subjective camera as an intermedial technique that mediates the stream of consciousness of the focalizer, Stephen Dedalus, as moving visual images. The camera eye functions as an ekphrastic device that invokes practice of the subjective camera and a phenomenological attempt to mimetically represent human sense perception, which constitutes a distinct part of the stream of consciousness. In summary, Cleo Hanway Oakley argues that Joyce's works represent phenomenological attempts to describe, quote, human engagement with the world through the senses. Sights and other perceptions are always filtered through human subjectivity. She identifies a key line of phenomenological thought in Joyce's works, specifically the human and the mechanical, and the mind and the body are interlinked in a variety of ways. Joyce achieves this interlinking through an innovative use of ekphrasis as he appropriates the subjective camera technique, thus presenting an organic, embodied model of the camera eye that emphasizes conceptual fusion of bodily visual perception with the camera. Keith Williams associates this fusion with the cinematicity of Joyce's works, which is predicated on a mobilized virtual gaze that mediates the visual perceptions of his focalizers, who function as intradiegetic camera eyes. We generally see with them, Williams explains, rather than see them. Memories, for example, highlight their subjective point of view at the time a particular event transpired. The camera eye metaphor underpins the free and direct discourse of portrait, which filters every sight through Stephen Dedalus' stream of consciousness, as well as those chapters of Ulysses that are presented through Stephen's point of view. So, just to wrap up, it can be said that Wordsworth's method in the Spots of Time acts as a foundational model for Joyce's own treatments of subjectivity, memory, vision, and temporality through the stream of consciousness. Thank you for listening to this presentation today.
We hope you have enjoyed this podcast. If you would like to comment on the podcast you have just listened to, or if you want to download more of our podcasts, visit our blog at www.readdurhamenglish.wordpress.com.